Good morning.
Good morning.
Pumps. These assholes, they always get away. Those were the words in that grown man's mouth as he followed in the dark a 17-year-old boy who he didn't know. And excuse my language, but those were his words, not mine.
Can't just kill him up for no reason and get away with it, shout. Gotta have some justice. Whether it's street justice or legal justice.
I'm Trey Farmer. In the hood, I can walk anywhere I want. Don't shoot me, I can do anything I want. I'm Trey Farmer. In the hood, I can walk anywhere I want. Don't shoot me, I can do anything I want.
I'm sick and I'm nauseous. This is obnoxious, even though that is obvious how they freely comply. We was reaching for freedom, now we seeking out justice. Then they get away with it, like they paid off the judges. Mama and daddy crying, sad that their son died. Cause killers on TV, telling these foolish lies. Ironic is advertised, I vomit on genocide. They taking away fresh fly, gotta cover my daughter's eyes. And visually, repeatedly, I feel like they keep beating me. It's 1957, they killing people senselessly. I see this all so vividly, I'm losing my identity. The world is in a crisis, gotta walk with he who's stricken me.
I'm Trey Farmer. In the hood, I can walk anywhere I want. Don't shoot me, I can do anything I want. I'm Trey Farmer. In the hood, I can walk anywhere I want. Don't shoot me, I can do anything I want.
I walk the streets in my hoodie, no flexing, just coolin', packing juice and some Skittles. So why did he shoot me? It went from innocent living, them blows were given. I don't know how he was driven to the point of no feeling. See, I don't play with folks chillin', so why you come follow me? It's self-defense. Ain't nobody harming me.
About
black and starving, so you call us retarded. Now we building them skills like Malcolm and Martin.
Amen.
We don't listen to our sharpener. I'ma be the starter. You talking about a circus? We do this for a purpose. The world is filled with cluttery. People speaking utterly. I'm about to bow on and don't care about who governs.
I'm Trey Farmer. In the hood.
Pistol into Trayvon Martin's chest and pulled the trigger. And then, as the smoke and the smell of that fatal gunshot rose into a rainy Sunday Sanford night, Trayvon Martin, 21 days removed from his 16th year, was face down in wet grass, laboring through his final breaths.
Black power, and more black power to my people, power to oppressed people. This is your brother, soldier in arms, comrade in battle. This is Sean Saddam Kweli. I'm broadcasting live from right here in the hills and smells of North America. As always, this is a privilege. This is a joy. It is an esteemed honor for me to be able to talk to you from this platform. My sisters, my brothers, and some others from this bold, beautiful, revolutionary radio broadcast called Power Radio. And as we do every Monday night, by the grace of the Creator, the Divine Supreme Architect, we come to you with hard-hitting facts, We come to you with the latest dialogue, the latest information. We come to you bringing you the truth from a black nationalist, pan-Africanist perspective, meaning that we must have some of this good earth to call our own. We must have some territory to call our own. In the meantime, in between time, we must be able to control what's happening in our own neighborhoods and happening within our own communities. And so we open up this show giving thanks to the God of our ancestors and the God of our forefathers and foremothers, and we believe that the God answers to many different names. And so regardless to land, label, or language, we bear witness that there is but one God. We ain't tripping. Whether you say Ukulukulu, whether you say Lord God Almighty, whether you say Jehovah, or Yahweh, or Elohim, or Yemenyah, or Obachala, or Oshun, or Ogun, some say Asa, the feminine, Aset. Some say Akhenaten. Others say Allah. Others in another part of Southern Africa just hold one finger up in the air. But however you give credence to that divine, respective architect of the universe and creation, we give thanks. We're here giving you greetings in your own language. If you say Assalamu Alaikum, or if you say Hotep, or if you say Shalom, or if you say a Bargani, or if you say free the land, if you say peace to the gods, peace to the earth, or if you simply say what's up, we here live, the students of the Honorable Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad from that revolutionary platform, of that vanguard vehicle for black liberation and theology, the new Black Panther Party for self-defense. It's Monday night. This is Black Power Radio. And we are here to define, develop, and defend what is in the best interest of our people. We are here to define, develop, and defend what is in the best interest of our people. Giving thanks to all of our ancestors, male and female, all of those who ruled civilizations, all of those who established the first governments, all of those who were the originators of the sciences and arts and cultures of the world. We give thanks to all black inventors and all of those who put their contributions, not only here in the United States of America, but all across the globe. We give thanks to all of our freedom fighters who, when the transatlantic slave trade and the Black Holocaust, which is 100 times worse than any other Holocaust out there, happened to our people, that our freedom fighters stood up and fought hard to liberate a people who were made captive and captured and put into a colonized state and robbed of original names and robbed of language and robbed of culture and folkway and foray and norm and robbed the power of their own being. We're talking about the black man and the black woman, the African in America. We're talking about the so-called Negro here in the hells and smells of North America, lost and dead to a knowledge of self, scripturally called Lazarus in the book called Bible, in your grave clothes and in our grave clothes, that has to be raised up out the grave, the mental grave, not physical grave, but the mental grave and the spiritual grave and the cultural grave, to once again walk a living perpendicular and be the original man and woman, original rulers, the kings, the queens, the owners of it all, the baddest black people anywhere in the world. That's what we're on the threshold of, and that's what we are in the process of pushing towards. We are talking black economics tonight. And we're going to talk black economics tonight in a real way. We're not going to talk it in no spooky way, no alakazam, puff, huff of smoke. We're going to talk it in a real way, because all of you out there, all of us, need some money, of course. We need money to survive. We need money to thrive. We have to have it, quote unquote, in the capitalistic society that was set up and imposed on us. We want to talk about some real wealth, about some real circulation of the black dollar. We want to talk about some things that we can do to discipline ourselves so that we are not the number one consumers of the country, but that we can be the creators and the manufacturers, and that we can have our own gross domestic product, talking about nationalizing things that we use on a daily basis. Why do we have to pay millions to Fruit of the Loom and millions to Hanes when our people pick the cotton that Hanes and Fruit of the Loom developed this entire pleating line and boxer line and other kind of lines, T-shirt lines on? Our people should be the producers and the manufacturers of our own undergarments, our own clothing and clothing lines. We should have our own stores. And in fact, about it, we should have been there a long time ago. We had it during the Reconstruction days, in the Reconstruction era. And unfortunately, because many of our people at that time believed that we could share power and believed that there was no need to have military power or self-defense coupled with economic power, our people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Black Wall Street and other areas in the South and other places were bombed out of their economics. Mayors and governors and others, senators, all black, controlling their own resource, controlling their own economy, were bombed out of their resource and bombed out of their economy. So we want to talk real wealth in North America and throughout the world, and establishing a black economy that can and will be supported by black people that you can benefit from, to where it's not an elitist economy that only benefits a few or only helps a few. But we want a real economy where the pitiful poor black man and black woman on the street, the homeless on the street, or the middle class, or even the so-called bourgeoisie, if needed, can benefit. Talking about black wealth and black economy. Joining us on the radio show shortly will be a black man. We've got a couple of bold black men on tonight, but joining us in the first hour will be a black man who is considered one of the greatest of all activists produced in the 1960s, coming up out the South. He has been all over the country, all throughout Africa and other areas, worked as a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee called SNCC. He is a man who has organized at that time sit-ins, countless sit-ins, and marches and demonstrations and boycotts, all of the maneuvers that were instrumental in destroying the overt forms of Jim Crow and racial oppression that were prevalent against our people less than just 30 years ago. He is a man who was all up and down the roads working with the SCLC, or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, helping our people to exercise their political power to vote. A black man who organized in the South, not only with Martin Luther King Jr., who we built a long-term relationship with, and we say Ashe for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but he also organized with the bold black man who pushed through his South and pushed the militant actions of many of the radicals in the South, man formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture. He organized with them in what was called, and helped to form what was called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party with Sister Fannie Lou Hamer, Ashe, and some others. Then we're on down into Alabama and organized a organization that you hear me speak highly of and a lot of, because many of you don't know the full history of the Panther Party, or the Black Panther Party. But the first Black Panther organization formed, the first Black Panther Vanguard organization formed on the shores of North America was not in Oakland, California in 1966. It was Lowndes County Freedom Organization on the ballot, the Black Panther Party, as it was known, before 66, 64, 65, down in Lowndes County, Alabama. And this same brother was organizing with Kwame Ture, organizing with others in that formation. He became a key organizer in Tuskegee, Alabama, where Sammy Young Jr. was shot in the head with a shotgun for using a white-only toilet. And in that same year, he was put in charge of organizing students under what was called the Campus Travelers Program. These are Black men and women, and this is a Black man who believed in armed self-defense long before some others had called for it. I'm talking about a Black man known as Mukasa Ricks Dada, formerly Willie Ricks. Baba and Dr. Mukasa Dada will be on with us in just a few short minutes to talk about the state of Black people, the condition of our people, as he's seen it in the Deep South and throughout the country and as it exists today. And also talk about what we can do to exercise our Black dollars and what they are doing and the expertise that they are putting in place to stop us wantonly spending money with every bloodsucker and every capitalist in our community, and now the money comes back home. Mukasa Ricks Dada will be joining us tonight in about 15 minutes. He is credited with coining the phrase Black Power. So all of you out there, all of you Black Power advocates, and I am one who advocates for Black Power, Black people to have power to determine their own and our own divine destiny amongst ourselves. It is Willie Ricks, formerly Willie Ricks, Brother Mukasa Ricks Dada, who is responsible yelling out Black Power and organizing for Black Power in the way that we do. And so we're going to be talking to a living legend tonight. A living legend tonight. But this is a show of legends. It has to be, because following up behind Baba Willie Ricks Dada will be another bold Black man who is a Black nationalist and believes in Black power, and he's also an attorney and a very successful businessman and business mogul, an international traveler who has worked with princes all up, like the Saudi princes, and worked with all kinds of influential people all around the world. He was formerly known in the 60s as Don Warden, worked with those like Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, and gave them a information or two on how to organize and push forward. See, there's people behind the scenes that you don't hear about because they're not put before the Hollywood cameras. And so you got to know the history and know how this movement has got from point A to point B, and it's moved the way it's moving. This Black man did not agree with the integration of the Black Power movement or the Black Panther Party. He split. He didn't like it. So he believes staunchly in Black nationalism and Black people doing it for themselves. He organized for himself and ultimately helped to pin a song that you learn a lot about coming up, and you hear all the time on commercials, and you hear all the time in Black History Month, and all the time on your radio. If you have heard the song, say it loud, "I'm Black and I'm Proud," from Brother James Brown, may the Creator be pleased with him, then you have to give that credit and that penmanship to our brother who will be joining us tonight behind Brother Mukasa Ricks Dada, Dr. Khalid Al-Mansour. He's going to be on with us, and he's going to discuss this black dollar and what's going on with our money and why we are spending money the way that we're spending it, like it's going out of style. What type of slave attitude is this that has caused us to spend money in a way to where we can build nothing for ourselves and we have nothing to show of it as a nation of people, but yet we continue to finance a nation that has bankrupted us and robbed our greats of their ideas, and they continue to thrive off of the black economy and black economics, even in a negative sense. The prison industrial complex is full of young black males and young black females, NBA full of young black males and young black females, golf overrun now by black males and females, tennis taken over by black females and males, anything that you can name that is pivotal in America, whether it's engineering, science, whether it's technology, black people are all behind it. The construction of the White House itself, black people did that. Black people did that. Ebony Magazine just put out a magazine a few weeks ago. I think it was about a week or so ago, where they're talking about the 100 most influential black people, people that you don't even know about, who have all kind of areas of expertise. And with all of this expertise out here, it's amazing that we have not thought to yet do for ourselves and go for ourselves, but yet we still continue to beg our former slave master and their children and their children's children for that which we can unite and have to unite and do for ourselves. So when talking about the black economy and talking about now what's coming up on Black Friday, quote unquote, what's coming up, we should talk about the reasons that it is important that we use at least 10% to 12% at the least of our monies to buy black on this coming Black Friday and to buy black in this so-called holiday season and all the time. You ready? You gearing up. Some of you listening to me right now, you're gearing up to go spend your money in these stores. You're gearing up to buy as many presents as you can and gift wrap, as many presents as you can. Some of you will go in debt to spend money to keep up with the Joneses, and at the same time, you're making those so-called Ashkenazi Jews who are waiting for your prophets and others rich behind your crazy spending. We have to create our own jobs. If we don't create our jobs, who's going to create jobs? Do you think that we can advance economically while begging the white man for a job? Do you think we can advance economically while begging for a job? Do you see any other culture out here? Do you see the whites out here? Do you see the so-called Jews out here? Do you see the Asians out here seeking to flock into the black business? Or are they running into their own businesses? Community power, as explained by Dr. Boyce Watkins, is accumulated by those who are committed to the idea of building something that is greater than themselves. The word community is predicated on the selfless notion that we all contribute to the grand ideal and do what is necessary to build something for our children and grandchildren. And if you don't feel that you owe anything to the black community, then the fact is that the black community owes nothing to you. Our children, our babies, our future will be watching all that we do. Do you want your children to go through the same stress, the same disappointment of stumbling through corporate white America and end up angry as the rest of the black middle class or the so-called middle class? Maybe you and maybe me and we should give our children a chance to get off of the economic and psychological plantation The first step towards being economically free is to become psychologically free. So we cannot, brothers and sisters, raise our children in the cage of irresponsible and unintelligent conception. It gives us the opportunity by buying black to change the definition of Black Friday. The word black is already there, so maybe the Creator, God Almighty, is trying to tell you something. Originally, Black Friday was a slave term when they would have the most auction offer, the auctioneer offer the slave. The black slave would be a Black Friday. But now black people have more spending power. If we would just unite our dollars and just unite our forces, black people have more spending power than the whole combined country of Turkey, the whole combined country of Australia, and the whole combined country of Taiwan. Our money is power, brothers and sisters, and you shouldn't just give it away. And the truth is that compared to much of the rest of the world, we in the black community are filthy rich. When you look at how much money we waste, how much money we spend frivolously, how much money we don't save, and how much money leaves our community, we are a filthy rich people. We are the richest former slaves or descendants of slaves to be found anywhere in the world. If you buy black, you will be able to answer your critics and answer your enemies. You'll be able to answer the Bill O'Reillys. You'll be able to answer the Sean Hannitys. You'll be able to answer the Rush Limbaughs and the Ku Klux Klan, the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists and the racist pigs and those neo-Confederates and all of them. You'll be able to answer those in the power structure and those on a poor level who say that you can't stick together, who say that black people can't stick together. If you buy black and you support black and you support the black business, you at the least will be able to answer your critics and answer those who say we can't. Economic equality is the next step or perhaps the most important step in what you call your civil rights movement. That civil rights movement is what gave you that political power. But when you fail to listen to the former leadership, fail to listen to the Dr. King, and fail to listen to the Malcolm X, who taught us the importance of obtaining economic power, fail to listen to your Marcus Messiah Garvey, fail to listen to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you fail to listen to those who taught us about economic power and having political power without economic power. That's like having a driver's license and you can't even afford to get your car. That's why the gains of the black nation, the gains of black people, have been rolled backwards. Strong black businesses build more strong black businesses. Imagine if every great black baseball player had stayed in the black league or the so-called Negro leagues. A professional sports league gives birth to thousands of small businesses whose livelihood is contingent upon the success of the league. When the Negro leagues disappeared, the businesses disappeared along with it. Integration has not always been our friend. It's not our friend. At least in this racist American society. If you buy black, it will give you a chance to resurrect Black Wall Street. Black Wall Street was the name or the nickname for Tulsa, Oklahoma, the community that learned the secret of keeping its dollars inside its own neighborhoods. As a result, blacks in the community were doing better than the whites across town, and this did not sit well with the white man and white woman, leading to the community being, as I told you, bombed to the ground. Similarly, the internet is a virtual community. This radio is a virtual community where people are connected demographically rather than geographically. By conquering and occupying Black Friday and buying black on this Black Friday and buying black during this holiday season, it gives you a chance to circulate your dollars among one another instead of giving all your money away. There are a few cures for racism better than creating there's not many more cures for racism than creating a few more black millionaires who know what to do. And then finally, because we have to, jobs that pay, a living wage are disappearing, and black people are engaging in the fastest economic moonwalk in history. If we don't come to terms with how to survive in this capitalistic society, the fact is you will not be surviving at all. You got to do it. You have to buy black. You have to take control of your wallets. We have to not be afraid of our own greatness. And so, brothers and sisters, right now it is my pleasure and my honor to bring to you our national chairman of the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, who will be introducing our first guest to Black Power Radio. Help me to welcome and bring on Minister Hashim Nzinga, our national chairman. Black Power, Brother Chairman, welcome to the radio broadcast.
Black Power, Brother Sean, National Chief of Staff. Like always, you firing up these airways and teaching the people. And thank God for Black Power Radio. We always want to give honor to a person who brought us down this road and have made us steadfast on this road and dig in on this road, and that's the Honorable Dr. Khaled Muhammad. Then we want to say Black Power and salute our Black Power General, who I'm sure is somewhere listening, our national chairman of 12 years, as our big brother and CEO of Black Lawyers for Justice, Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz. And I want to say hello and Black Power to the Black Power Nation and the new Black Panther Party members and national, regional, and all. Man, it's good to have Solomon's mentality and do the paradigm of Solomon. Solomon, who said, "I am black," he said, "Just give me wisdom, brother. Just give me knowledge." Because, Brother Sean, when you get the wisdom and the knowledge, all the other stuff you would want in life would come underneath your feet. That's why we're finna walk down here, and we're finna revisit 20-some years of doing this Black Power movement, new Black Panther Party, and finna do it right. And we so glad that you're talking about economics, so glad that we got vast, vast reach that we're going to deal with this economic thing, and that's why we're about to, under my couple of weeks chairmanship, we're about to do this, get our website back up, all new and improved, get this newspaper back going, and get these newsletters back going and these meetings back going so we can teach and talk to our people. But the first thing we got to deal with as we do that, and we know how to do it right after so many times doing it, we have to deal with right now. Right now we got some people that paid Zimmerman way for killing Trayvon and murdering Trayvon, and we both know that there was a Fortune 500 corporations that paid for Trayvon's murder. How did they do it? They put millions of dollars behind protecting this killer, which sends the message to other killers that it's okay to kill black people. Fortune 500 companies will pay your way through court. These are the companies that we spend money at. Have we forgotten about that list? But today, brother, I just was praying and I was thinking of what we need to do with our people. And one of the things I know we need to do with our people.
Hold on this call, phone number.
Brother Sean, hold 1 second. Talk to the people, give me 1 second. I got a call coming in with Dr. Mansour. I got to take 2 seconds and we'll get ready to bring Mikasa Rick on. Hold 1 second.
Yes, sir. And so the number to call, brothers and sisters, will be 646-478-4447. 646-478-4447. We are on live right now.
I'm on my damn radio show.
Master Cribbin.
That's too important.
Master Cribbin, who will be introducing our guest, Brother Mikasa Rick Stoddard, who coined the phrase Black Power. And it's a magnificent organizer. We're just getting things together. You tell a neighbor, you tell a friend, we are live on the air right now. You ready? Okay, he's not ready. We are live on the air. And to get this information to you, brothers and sisters, because it's important. As I told you, the black business is doing a moonwalk. The black economic dollar doing a moonwalk. Most of your pockets are doing a moonwalk.
Brother
Sean. Yes, sir.
All right, black power. You know how it goes when we're out here in the trenches. But to the radio listening audience, we decided to do two things tonight. Our first guest, everybody knows, is our ambassador to the new Black Panther Party. His history is well known. Brother Mikasa Rick worked with people like H. Rob Brown and Stokely Carmichael and all the original Panthers, and worked with Dr. King and so many, been in so many struggles. And we want to go back before we go forward and listen to some of our original orchestrators of struggle and protest and see where are we at now compared to where they were at this time in their lives. Then we want to bring on Dr. Khaled Al-Mansour because he has sent over 1,600 Africans from America to Africa who have never came back to America, who works in Africa right now, is president or founder of 7 banks in Africa, is the senior advisor of the Saudi Arabian Prince, which is one of the richest brothers in the world. And we all know Dr. Mansour has a vast, vast history of being one of the most powerful black men in America. Was with the original Black Panther Party, was out there at Berkeley with people like Bobby Seale and Huey Newton. We all know he wrote the song I'm Black and I'm Proud with James Brown, and what came a theme song for the original Panthers. We just said before we get these crackers all our money during these holidays, we're going to go back to some financial advisors and some brothers who have struggled in this struggle so many years. And so what we're going to do at this point, we're going to get – do you got Mikasa's number there?
Is he calling in? Yes, sir. Is he calling in?
Let me just call him then.
Okay,
hold
sir.
One sec.
Yes, sir. Yeah, brother, as we pull Brother Mikasa Rick's song, we always appreciate you. I want you to know that if you ever need to get in contact with the new Black Panther Party and to support this movement, and many of you all have been asking how to join the movement and to become a part of the Black Power movement to better our
community. Mikasa Rick.
Sir.
Welcome to Black Talk Radio. I was just telling our audience somewhat of your vast history. I couldn't tell your history in 2 weeks, let alone 30 minutes.
Well, I lived it for 60 years, so it'd be pretty difficult to tell it in an hour.
But we are the babies of Mikasa Rick, and as you know, we done rode in the front seat driving you to many events and getting your advice on many things we have done over the past 23 years. And this is a crossroad. We're at the crossroad here in Black America again. And I know you've been at this crossroad many times. And I told our National Chief of Staff, Brother Sean Kwali, who's the host of the show, that what we're going to do with Black Power Radio tonight, we're going to go back and find some of our originals. We got the holidays coming up where our people is about to run out and give white corporate America all of their money and credit card debt for the next half year to 2 years sometime. And we're trying to put together some common sense, Brother Mikasa, to talk to our people about how important it is now to invest that money in our children's education, into understanding that we have to put that money up now and build a nation within this nation and a nation of our own, and some of us got to get the hell out of this nation. But I don't want to take no more time. What I want to do, Brother McCossum, I want you to go back. I want you to think about when you was a fresh age of 20, 21, 19, and you couldn't eat at lunch counters. You couldn't go in certain stores. You couldn't drink out of certain water faucets. You had to use a black mechanic, a black bus, a black taxi, a black grocery store, a black service station. You had to go to find a black pharmacy, a black doctor, a black insurance company. Now the only thing, brothers and sisters, you, black brother McCossum, is the funeral home. And I want you to go back and tell us, have these times hurt us now that we spend all our money with other people? Black people ain't got nothing no more. And I'll be quiet and let you talk and let Brother Sean take over. And I know we're going to have some people want to ask you some questions, Brother Baba McCossum.
To make it simple, remember, we just used Tulsa, Oklahoma. And when there was a racial incident, they got ready to hang a brother, and the community said no and stood together. They went up in airplanes and burnt down Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Greenwood District, or what little place where they call Little Africa, where all our businesses were, and took over all our land. And I said that to say, before they passed the Civil Rights Bill and the Voters' Rights Bill, we had thousands and hundreds of thousands of businesses all over this country. In every community where we live, we had streets full of African business. Whatever we did, we did in black hotel. We slept in a hotel, we slept in a black hotel. If we ate in a restaurant, we ate in one of our restaurants. And on and on and on. You went to a shoe store, you went to our shoe store, unless you went in the back door of a white man's shoe store. And all that. But after they passed the Civil Rights Bill, they used that to take over all our land. One time we had 53 million acres of land in this country. Today we're down to 2 or 3 million. And that's most of that's lots. We had businesses everywhere. And they took over our business and gave them to the Japanese, Korean, and Indians in India, and took over our service station, gas stations, and gave them. We don't have those no more. And we had restaurants, McDonald's, all them ran us out of business. But all of the things that we had in our neighborhood that generated our economy, and we lived as a nation. We was considered a nation within a nation. And today, all that's gone. So they used the so-called Civil Rights Bill to tighten the noose up on our necks. And today, everything in every business and everything we do, Europeans, white America, we got to go to them for it. Everything, every personality we have that's speaking to us, especially through the television, they're doing nothing but reading the white man's script. And they put dummies before us to talk, or people they have taken their manhood away and make them almost talk like girls. They have robbed us, and the only thing, they have taken our men out the houses, and now they attack our children with crack and thousands of other ways, and they are holding our men in the prison industrial complex in slavery in these jails, and so we are basically being clearly, without a doubt, put back in slavery. And then they have gone back to lynching and hanging and murdering like they did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. They hung, cut our penis off, stick in our mouth, lay on the side of the road. But they used all that to put fear in us, burn down our school, churches, assassinate our leaders, whatever. And today we see all of our children being assassinated. A little girl just got her head shut off in Detroit somewhere. But then there are thousands of young men being killed. The Ku Klux Klan has changed uniform. They now wear blue uniforms. The Grand Dragon no longer wear a red uniform or a white uniform, but but he wear a judge uniform, and he's giving our people hundreds and hundreds of years in the prison system. So the and then they're using our young people after Dr. King called for people not to go into the army, not to fight wars for imperialism, not to fight wars for the United States. Dr. King called for that. Now all the so-called leaders and civil rights leaders and all these so-called spokesmen for our people appointed by white people are telling our children to go into the army. They're not speaking out against the Martin Luther King spoke out against the President of the United States. These people are not speaking out against the President of the United States, who's a warmonger, who killing people in Afghanistan and Iraq and all over Africa, and Congo and Somalia and other places in Africa. These people are not saying anything. Matter of fact, the reactionary neo-colonialist Uncle Tom kind of leaders that the Democrats and America has bought out of our people are such a great cowards. If Dr. King was living today, they wouldn't have allowed him, his children, and Andrew Young, and none of these people, and Sharpton, all of them, they wouldn't have allowed Dr. King to speak at the March on Washington. He would have been too militant for him. So I'm saying that to say that we need a revolution. We need to organize our people, and that the revolutionary of today have to go back to school and learn from those people that organized in the 60s, not just the civil rights so-called movement, but the organizers of the 60s, because before, every community had a group of people that they were working with. Like each one of us, every organization, if you're an organization, you should have a youth movement where you can vouch for 20, 30, 40, or 50 young people that you're dealing with, guiding, directing, teaching, educating, and giving the right directions to, and you should be able to call on those 50 people at all times. But many of these organizations now, they're just talking the game, and they're basically paper tigers. And I think that a lot of people that's coming out of our movement today, even out of the Pan-Africanist movement, a lot of these people are nothing but theoreticians and paper tigers, and that we need people that can go and organize our people and deal with our people who's going through drugs and going through miseducation and going through hunger and pain and being misdirected. We need people that can direct our people the right way. And if we don't have people that can direct our people the right way, and you're not out there doing that, then you're not an organization. You're just organization in name. As a matter of fact, you're paper tigers. And that what we are being surrounded now with is a bunch of paper tigers. And I think there are a lot of people that came out or went into even our Pan-Africanist movement. They have become paper tigers, or what Dr. King called, they suffer from paralysis of the analysis. In a way, they can explain everything in the world, but they can't do nothing on the corner that they live on. They can talk about how to organize and what's going on in the Congo, but they can't organize a kid on Jones Street or Martin Luther King Avenue and what have you. So we need some organizers and not just people. We need to come to our analysis through concrete work and organization and not just people that's out here talking and bullying up to this imperialism. This imperialist don't take bullies. So just trying to bully the imperialists, you ain't going to get nowhere. And the only time you're going to get somewhere is organization and developing troops that we have educated and guided and directed, and young men and women, girls and boys, that we have protected and showed the way and showed what a movement is and showed them revolutionary songs, revolutionary art. I showed them our true African history and culture, showed them revolutionaries throughout the world, and changed their thinking and their outlook, and that's the kind of thing we got to do. So we got to do more than just give analysis about revolution or analysis about the movement, but we got to be out here practicing and showing that we really doing and got a whole lot of people doing day-to-day operation and day-to-day work on what's going on in the movement and what's going on in the struggle. Today we just don't have it. And that a lot of these so-called brothers and sisters basically has become paper tigers. And they're no longer a threat against the imperialists or what have you. And the unfortunate thing, too, is that even if you've gotten old or you can't do it or whatever, at least you could give. You can't give sweat to it. You could support young people that's out here trying to organize and make sure that they have transportation, an old car that you have, or make sure they have a pair of shoes or socks, or make sure they have money that they can operate on and have a budget. Because, I mean, I've been out here 50 years or more, more than 50 years, matter of fact, easily more than 50 years. And, yeah, I don't know who I could turn to if I'm attacked tomorrow and need $100. Who can I turn to? If I'm hungry, who can I turn to? And our people are not there anymore, and that we really need our people to turn inward toward us, because we're in a revolution, we're in a struggle, and we're in a bloody revolution, and our people are in a crisis, and we need to go back to the drawing board and see how do we go to the crisis. Like, we raise hell every time they shoot Trayvon. They shoot Trayvon every day. Every time they blow our heads off, they blow our heads off every day. We raise hell every time they put us in jails and prisons, and we are under attack 1,000 different ways. We cry out loud, but we don't have no movement, no organization, and we ain't making no blows against this imperialist, and we ain't doing no education of the people that this is happening to daily. And so they being in the United States and the Democratic Party, they mobilize these Uncle Toms and these people that work for them, and these people that's on the American government's payroll or the state of Georgia's payroll, whether you're in a teacher's profession or whatever. But if you're on their payroll, you can only think and say certain things. So they writing our agendas for us, and our people are no longer talking and struggling and educating our people toward where we must go. And the people that's got resources are not putting none of those resources toward the movement and toward the revolution. And a lot of people are glorifying themselves and not glorifying people. Matter of fact, we need people not for themselves to go to Africa, but we need people to organize where they can help send 10, 15 other people to Africa and get them get some experience and see Africa and see some traveling. So we need a way to, everybody should have some children and some young people that they have in motion where we can build us a movement, because we're in deep, 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 deep trouble. And genocide is being committed. And we have many of these young people have analysis, but they don't know what to do. Like, they don't have the practice to deal with it. And that we need people with analysis, but not only the analysis, we need people that's getting these analysis through practice and what have you. And that's what we need. We need soldiers that's on the battlefield and really out here working, teaching, and doing things that's concrete that the parents and everybody can see, and not just out here bullying at the imperialists and talking bad to them, because we need people to learn concrete education, concrete organization, and concrete movement. And we need people that's able to teach that. And right now, I think that we're at a lower area at that time, but at the same time, the imperialists is at a greater level of exploitation and killing and murdering and racist murdering than ever before. And they have thousands of militia groups and individual white people in groups and that have guns and bombs, and the government and what the government and the NSA and the CIA and the FBI and all the local police departments and other agents that they have, they're all fighting against the poor people and black people and the people of color, Mexicans and what have you. And they're trying to keep us divided. It's a national program to keep drugs in our community. And that's what they're doing, is keeping our people drugged. And so we need some kind of movement where we can begin to speak to the people and begin to say no to certain things and use certain ways to exploit our people. But they're making our people so ignorant, even when we call for a boycott, we still go run to Walmart and think Walmart is the savior, and Walmart is really putting people in the world back in slavery. Not only the people in the world, but people right here in the United States that work for Walmart, these people on welfare and food stamps. People that's on that work for Walmart, these people are, Walmart just had to pass some cans around and ask people to put some cans in a bucket where they could give, where the people at Walmart could have some food during the holidays. They so poor in Walmart working that they can't even afford to buy a dinner for these holidays that's coming up. Walmart has got people coming in the store to give cans to the Walmart workers. And that just shows you how dirty Walmart is and how much of a slave worker and a slave master that they are. And at the same time, Walmart and all them companies got people working in sweatshops making all the clothes that we wear right here in the United States, paying people $2 a week or what have you, and got people living in dormitories that's full of maybe 1,000 people with a lock on the dormitory, and can't nobody leave, and can't nobody come in. And
Brother Bob Mukasa.
Yes, sir.
That's a great point you just made, because I remember when Sam Walmart out of Arkansas started Walmart, and his big thing was the red, white, and blue flag, and he pushed so hard that if it wasn't made in America, it would not be in Walmart. The day after that man died, his sons went international and global, and now damn near 70% of anything in Walmart is coming out of China, as far as the little merchandising. You know, they'll buy the food from anybody who would give it to them in bulk quantities from anywhere in the world. So they exploit the world. And it's all about the New World Order. It's about controlling the people, food. It's about after a while you will only have Walmart to go through. They're slowly putting every business out. And once they become the godfather of the stores, it'll be Walmart or nothing in a minute in America.
Yeah, it's going to be Walmart and McDonald's and a few of them places like that. And matter of fact, they're making it so bad now, many people can't afford to eat at home. They eat Walmart, McDonald's and churches for lunch and dinner and what have you. All this stuff is genetic food that's filling our bodies with cancer and thousands of other diseases. And we dying from these sickness faster than the people dying from drugs, or faster than the people dying who can't get to a woman in the prison. We're dying. And we're
dying
a thousand different ways.
You know what's sick about it, though, Bob Mukasa? What's sick about it is Walmart used to push, and we're talking about corporate America, not just Walmart, but Walmart used to push, and we used to push, the reason we want to shop at Walmart, because it's cheap. But Walmart is not cheap no more. I mean, it's cheap if you're in CVS or somewhere like that. But on the real issue, Walmart is getting $9 and $10 for, they're getting the same prices that everybody else is getting. They got to psychologically whoop, and it just reminds me so much of Carter G. Woodson's book, The Miseducation of the Negro, where these people, like they said, once somebody psychologically have you going in a certain direction for so long, then they tell you you can come to the front door. He said we would go to the back door and take the board off the back door and still go in the back door. Walmart got our people like zombies, man. It's a crying shame that our ancestors and our grandfathers and great-grandmothers had those farms and those fresh greens and had those chickens running around feeding them with good feed and had those tomatoes and those watermelons and those pecan trees and those cantaloupes growing, and you would have to go out there and get that fresh cantaloupe and cut it open. Now we'll take a Walmart cantaloupe that then came from Chile. We don't know where it came from. Been on boats, trains, planes, trucks. By the time you eat it, ain't nowhere close to the word fresh.
And then they'll spray a pesticide on it.
So Makaza, this is what we chief of staff and the host to let us know where we are, because we got a second hour of the show. But I just want to say this, man. We love you, and I want to have you back on for 2 hours. But we want to play some of your clips. I got a lot of your clips at home on YouTube of you in the struggle and some of your speeches. And we want to let our listening audience really ask you the right questions, because my thing is becoming chairman of this organization is we're going to have to go backwards to go forward now. And we can't do it with sitting down with our elders and getting it right.
Well, we're in a revolution. Our fight is for Africa. Our fight is for the people to control our destiny. Our fight is for the young people to take over our movement and guide our people right and guide our people and make them strong. We in a revolution. We got to fight and take Africa back. That's our land, and we got to be socialists and spread the wealth among everybody and get rid of the rich and give everything to the poor. So thank you, Brother Africa.
Thank you so much, Brother Makaza. And
Africa, Black Power.
Look forward to bringing you back on.
Black Power. Long live Africa.
Brother Sean.
Yes, sir. Black Power.
We at the top of the hour?
Right at the top. One minute past.
Okay, we want to be respectful of our next guest. We're going to bring Brother Makaza back on because he's such a jewel. And like he said, we'd be talking about 23 years and 20 years. He had 50 years, and you very seldom ever hear him complain. He got his son over in Cuba, about to become a medical doctor. He walked the talk. He lived the talk. He goes to that college campus, man. If people only can see him on them college campuses, he just busts in one of them professors' class and start teaching. The professor better not go to the bathroom, Brother Sean. The professor better not go to the front office. He come back, Makaza be in there teaching hard, man. This is a legend, man. And man, I watched Angela Davis movie, I watched Winnie Mandela movie, and I'm watching so many people who fought so hard before us. We gotta slow down, man, and we gotta get this right, because our babies gonna suffer if we don't. We're gonna go to the next let me get our next guest on, and this time we're going to make sure that we get some callers on at the end, and we're going to bring Brother Makaza back, and we're going to pull out our archives on here, him, and play some clips for people can remember who he is and that he's right next door ready to go to work.
Yes, sir. We'll be standing by. Brother Tiller's number to call is 646-478-4447. And to email us, you email us at newblackpantherheadquarters@gmail.com. That's newblackpantherheadquarters@gmail.com. For those of you all with questions, how to join the movement, what we're about, how you can start a program in your area, that's the way to get us. We are right now at the top of the hour and standing by for Dr. Khalid Al-Mansour. And he'll be on with us in just a few short moments. I hope that you enjoyed Dr. Makaza Ricks. Got it. He'll be back on with us, man. Cannot squeeze Dr. Makaza Ricks in and just no short of the time. So he'll be back on for a full 2 hours. Stay tuned for that. And we're about to now experience Dr. Khalid Al-Mansour. And tell a neighbor, tell a friend again, we're on live. We're right here in the Hells and Smells of North America, kicking you this Black Power truth and this Black Power teaching. If you have a question, make sure you get in queue. And make sure that you press the number 1 so that the switchboard knows that you're in line and in queue. And if we go past the 10 o'clock hour, you'll be able to hear the rest of the show off of the line, off of the mainstream. You'll be able to hear it on your telephone communication, cell phone on your phone, but only cell phone or phones only. If you call in on that number, if you're listening via internet, we go past the 10 o'clock hour, you will be disconnected. So we'll try to give you a few minutes warning before 10 o'clock Eastern. But be on with us. Be on with us and hang in there with us. This is great information. We're talking to two legends tonight, Dr. Khalid Al-Mansour, and you just heard from Dr. Makaza Ricks. Brother Chairman, you back? Okay. And so he's trying to get a hold right now, like the Khalid al-Mansour. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing to be able to talk to men who walked with those like Minister Malcolm X and walked with those like Dr. Martin Luther King and have really put in some serious work. And, I mean, you heard what he said, basically, that the revolutionaries of today, those of us who are in the fight today, black men and black women today, we have the opportunity to still make the change we got to make right now today. Ain't nothing changed. Don't think now because Obama's in office, you don't have no fight. Don't think that. We got more of a fight now than ever. With our youth being miseducated and being wholly incarcerated and thoroughly infiltrated with education that's not there, there's a lot to fight for. We're talking about that black dollar. I want to know what you all think about that black dollar. What are some things we can do to circulate our monies and to make our money circulate in a better fashion amongst our community? Let me see if our chairman is back. Brother Chairman, you back with us? Brother Chairman, you back with us?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. I can hear you.
Wow. Okay. Man, that Mikasa is a jewel.
Fireball.
We, hold on. We got Dr. Mansour right now.
All right.
And talk radio. We're on Black Talk Radio, and we want to be clear to let you know live, while we got people listening all over the world, that you are a jewel that we really love and appreciate. And I myself, after knowing you 20-something years, I want you to know tonight that I don't take you for granted. I don't take the 40-some books you wrote for granted. I don't take you being consistent at your age for granted. I just believe when you tell the listening audience your name and what it means, that you're divine and you were sent here by God to do this work, and it's an honor and privilege that we get a moment of your time from time to time, because at your age, you still outwork us 2-1.
All right, so what time are we going to start tonight?
We're on live right now.
We are?
Yes, sir.
Right, let me go and change phone so it's a little clear. Give me 60 seconds.
Yes, sir. Brother Sean?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
I want you to work with me for this giant can give our listening audience something that will be recorded in history and something that can change our people's lives, not next week, but tonight.
Absolutely.
Hello.
Dr. Mansour, it's
Hello,
a couple of things.
We ready to go.
It's just a couple of things I'm going to ask, then I'm going to get back and I'm going to let you go. In writing 44 books and coming out of Pittsburgh, watching your father build a house with a wheelbarrow for all your brothers and sisters, and getting to Howard University and then to Berkeley, and leaving Berkeley, going into China and going all over the world, and being with some of the most powerful presidents of many, 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 many nations. And actually, people don't know you, Dr. Mansour. I've been fortunate to be with you so many times, I really know. And to be the senior advisor to one of the richest men in the world, Dr. Mansour, when do you say to the world, I've showed you and done all I can do, if we're not listening?
Well, I think that there are people who listen, and the obstacle for our race to listen started in slavery. So the most accomplished network for brainwashing was instituted in America among the 13 colonies. And they had components and contributors to make sure that no mistakes were made. So they took the most powerful institutions, and the leadership agreed that the most important challenge facing the colonists from England, France, Spain, Italy, the biggest challenge that they faced was how to reduce the slave to a zombie. Because to bring hundreds, if not thousands, of Africans in slavery to America, if at the same time you did not weaken and in many cases destroyed mental ability, it would mean that all the colonies would fall apart. There would be no future. And they therefore said to the churches, you have more members than anyone in America who are free. We're not talking about the American Indian. You free whites, you know what it was like in Europe. You know what you had to go through, Spain, Germany, Scandinavia. You know. And after you got here, you had to make a decision. And that decision addressed life and death. They said the life would be preserved for the white European immigrants. And the banner would read, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That was to teach little children, 3 and 4 years of age. Teach children in junior high, high school. Teach blue-collar workers looking for a job. So the network of the 13 colonies was to penetrate the mind of the Europeans on the platform of brotherhood. And then the farmers start saying, well, you know, some of these blacks, they don't understand English. They're coming from Africa. They don't know how to treat themselves. How can we control their behavior? Because if they start harming each other, it means that the American plantation system will collapse. It means that genocide would break out. So they got together, the churches. In the course of their prayers, they were saying, God, how can you help us enslave these black niggers? We cannot do it by ourselves. God, are you listening? We want them to be able to work. We want them to love to work, but we want them to be totally obedient. And we don't want them to know how to read or write. Now just think about that. When you're in school, from grade school, junior high, high school, why did years and years after slavery had been eliminated, why did the system, the books, why did the churches, why did the businessmen insist on reducing the slave to that of a zombie? Listen and obey. Then they told them that this may seem a bit harsh, but we want all of you black African, they use the word niggers, know your place. Don't expect to get rich in America. Don't expect to become even affluent. What you gear yourself for, what you teach your children from the day of the delivery of that child, you teach them that whites look like Jesus and you blacks look like the opposite of Jesus, whether it's the Father, the Son, or the Holy Ghost, you have been cursed. They did not open up the Bible, and I hope that everyone listening to this broadcast will take the Old Testament and ask themselves, did God respect blackness? And all you have to do, ladies and gentlemen and brothers and sisters, those in the penitentiary, those attending street rallies, those who are going to college, those who will not give up, I would like to help you just a little bit. There's a book called The Bible, and you will see the book divided into chapters. And you'll see one book that's called The Songs, S-O-N-G-S, The Songs of Solomon. And after all these years, about 3 or 4 years ago, I sat down to find out just what was this Brother Solomon talking about. And ladies and gentlemen and brothers and sisters and races of all the world, to the Native American Indian, the African, the Caribbean, to European, let me share with you Solomon's statement. Solomon was declared to be the most intelligent, the wisest man that ever lived. And fortunately for posterity, Solomon recorded his philosophic reflections. He said to God, I want people to know what you taught me. I want you to teach me, and I will spread the word. So in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there's a book called Songs, S-O-N-G-S, Songs of Solomon. That meant Solomon was the author. Songs of Solomon. So I said that after all these years, about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided to find out what exactly did Solomon say, because Solomon's father was David. And it came from a very powerful intellectual line. So I opened it up, and you can do the same thing. Go to your room and take your Bible, and you'll find a book entitled Song of Solomon's. And in the very first chapter, young, old, male, female, white, black, Indian, it doesn't matter. It is the same for everyone. It says, and I'm quoting, ye daughters of Jerusalem, this is Solomon speaking, I am black and I am comely. Now, Solomon was not a slave. Solomon was not born in England or France. Solomon said to the world, I am black and I am comely. Now, when I was very young, I didn't know what comely meant. I said, I don't know whether that's something bad or something good. But in the days when I grew up, if you said someone was black, that meant they were bad or evil or nasty, irresponsible, lazy. That's what black meant, whether you're on a plantation or you're not.
All the back of the card.
But I now opened it up. I said, Songs of Solomon, Brother Solomon, son of David, talk to me. What do you want to share with the entire world, whether it's Chinese, Japanese, Europeans, Africans, whatever you want to do, speak up. And Solomon said it. You won't hear it that often. But if you take your Bible and you turn to the Songs of Solomon, Solomon spoke and said, ye daughters of Jerusalem, this is Solomon talking now, I am black, and I am beautiful. Can I get a witness? Solomon,
that's right.
Put it in writing. How many of our parents teach us the meaning of being black and beautiful? How many teachers? When is the last time your pastor spoke to the congregation, quoting Song of Solomon, and said, I am black and good-looking. The word that was used was comely, C-O-M-E-L-Y. If you look up comely in the dictionary, it means good looking and beautiful. Solomon said, here is who I am. We black Americans, after slavery, we have more self-hatred than ever in our history. And that self-hatred spread because it was fostered by the slave master. He said, as long as I can keep blacks killing each other, as long as I can have black males beating up black females, as long as I can select blacks who are willing to be flunkies and obedient and who will talk about being a slave to God. Reading Solomon, Solomon said, I'm black. He didn't say I'm black and I'm ugly. If he said that, our race would still be in the cemetery. He said, you daughters of Judah. He wasn't talking to white people. He was talking to sisters. You daughters of Jerusalem. That's a personal pronoun. I am black and I am beautiful. When is the last time your parents told you they were black and beautiful? When is the last time your teachers told you, I may not be black, but I know black is beautiful? Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived, he told the world, but it's been suppressed. You didn't learn it in kindergarten. You didn't learn it in the first grade, the second, all the way to eighth grade of high school. So it was used as a weapon to cause you to hate yourself. Self-hatred was bred in order that the slave was be always obedient to the slave master. The slave master, white, the slave, black, and the Indians said, we ain't going for none of it. We're going out to the Arizona and other places where no one's going to go. Our leaders gave up. They said, this is too tough, this is too hard. I'll just take out. It's all right for white people to beat me, but I'm not going to let any black people beat me. Black people better not curse me. If they do, I'm going to tell Mr. Charlie, the white man, and he'll beat him up. So we learned over 300 years how to hate one another. It wasn't a movie. It wasn't a television show. It was the churches and the schools. It was our parents who internalized that black is ugly and white is beautiful. And for many in our race, we are not reading Solomon. Why is it not that the pastors or the teachers or the intellectuals or the economists do not stand up? Why not? They come on every morning and saying, let us quote Solomon, I'm black and beautiful. Black calling or recognizing or defining person as a black may usher you to a predetermined graveyard. The question now is, are we going to go on forever pitying ourselves? Are we going to go on forever talking about what the churches haven't done? Are we going to go on forever talking about what our parents didn't do? Or are we going to imitate the wisest man that ever lived, according to the Bible, the Book of Solomon? Solomon raised his voice. Solomon was the son of David. He said, you daughters of Jerusalem, to me, I am black. And if he had stopped, man, we'd be messed up. If he had just said, I'm black, you know, our imagination would run away. See, I told you, blacks are nothing. So Solomon made sure there would be no mistakes. Even until this day, Solomon said, let me tell you, brother and sister, I am black and comely. C-O-M-E-L-Y. That means beautiful. Solomon said, you daughters of Jerusalem, talking about Solomon, I'm black and I'm beautiful. When is the last time we told our mothers, fathers, children, brothers, sisters, members of the race, we are black? In Africa today, the movement is toward racial pride. Racial pride. Not feeling hatred for any race, but feeling pride and thankful that God made blacks. God didn't have to do that. He could have made everyone white. He could have made everyone yellow. Solomon said, I don't want you to be confused, and I don't want you to listen to propaganda. So I'm going to write it down. You can turn to your Bible tonight. Testament, there's a name, Song of Solomon. The first chapter. You don't have to go to read the entire book. Just chapter one, you will be able to listen in on Solomon. More important than a football game, a basketball game. More important than a street fight. More important than disrespecting yourselves or your children. Solomon said, I am black. Unless you get the wrong impression, I'm good looking. I am beautiful. And he used that. You realize that Solomon was regarded as the wisest man in the world. So no one can tell you if you're black, you're going to be dumb and retarded and ugly. The smartest, the wisest man that ever lived. More intelligent than Abraham, Isaac, Adam. What did he say in his wisdom? Black and beautiful. That's why this radio broadcast is opening your eyes. They are talking to you. The moderator on the radio is saying to you, it's now or never. Look in the mirror. Can you say what Solomon said? I am black and beautiful. Maybe if I kind of rest a little bit in my tongue, I can get some response from you. But why don't you do me a favor? The first thing, say, Brother Khaled, I'm black and beautiful. Then we go from there. Thank you very much. Hello?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're still here. Make sure.
All right. If they want to call in, I'm ready. If not, I'm still ready.
Hey, Brother Sean, let's do this. Brother Khaled, first of all, I know I'm black. And I'm beautiful, but I want you to tell a story because our listening audience, for the most part, are black and beautiful and revolutionary. But that ain't going to get it all the way. We got to have some action to go with that now. And
well,
I want you to tell them about when you were sitting around at Berkeley with a bunch of sophisticated people, how you took this action and changed the world with it. And made a theme song that carried us for some 30 or 40 years and still carrying us. And it's very important that we go over this every time we get you on the show because we got different young listeners. But we need to learn with our rappers and our entertainers that's taking over the world with music. We need to, and we're not that fortunate all the time to get an author of 44 books, but also a brilliant mind that knew how to put people together at a young age. And put this theme song together called I'm Black and I'm Proud, and then made Jane Brown say it loud, and it changed black America, and it made us walk different, made us talk different, made us act different. And we on this, me and Brother Sean and the New Black Panther Party and others, we want you to tell us this story because this is history. And we're about history making and changing history, but we're fortunate to have you on, and we appreciate you, and we love you. But that story can be told from you, the author of it, and our audience get the privilege to hear it, and I would appreciate it if you go through that because that changed the 60s and the 70s for us.
Well, first of all, my father got married when he was 30 years of age, and my mother was 15 years of age. My mother was from Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and my father was from Louisville, Kentucky. In the fifth grade, his teacher in one of the classes accused him of throwing spitballs at students in the classroom. And he tried to tell the teacher that's not true. And she said, well, who threw the spitballs around? He said, I'm not going to discuss that, but I can tell you that I did not do it. And that teacher dismissed him from the school and said, you will never have a chance to learn again. So my father operated elevators, served food on boats, but he would not give up. My mother was 15 when she got married to my father, who was 30, and they never divorced. They had 12 children. I was number 11 of 12. My father at that time had a position at the post office operating the elevator. And that job made him realize more than anything that he, over time, had 12 children. You can't sit in and roll in and crawl in. You can't depend it on a neighborhood of trees, a dairy that's about 2-3 miles away. My father built a house. He designed. He went to the library. He was due the post office to operate the elevator at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. 5 days a week. And then he started, little by little, saving enough money to get cement, gravel, sand. First he went to the library and he taught himself how to design a house. He designed a mansion. And as my mother and father had 12 children, over time, they tried to set the stage. They're very religious. They tried to set the stage. Gradually, little by little, that area became predominantly white. There was only one black family in the entire community. And they were not too kind. They were not too friendly. They didn't mind going to church on Sunday, but every other day, including Sunday, they said that we, the warden people, are nothing but niggers. Over time, my older brothers, sisters moved away as quickly as possible. My father stayed there. He grew the food because he couldn't afford. How are you going to feed all those kids? Pushing the plow, growing cabbage, corn, grapes, plums. He would try to set a tone for the importance of education. On Saturday, we would go down with the wagon, go down to the store and pull the groceries back. When they were leaving the sand and gravel so that my father could build and complete the house that he designed for himself, his wife, and the children. Remember, my father got married when he was 30. My mother was 15 years of age, and they both worked to support the family. No excuses. You didn't find anyone drunk. You find my mother and father sacrificing everything for 12 children. I was number 11, and some of the children were more intelligent than others. To be very frank with you, I wasn't the most intelligent of the 12 children. In fact, I probably somewhere around 10 or 11. But my father said, move on. Then my father had a sister. And when she came to visit us from time to time, she would try to encourage the family. And she received a degree in 1895 in the city of Chicago, and one of the most prestigious universities in Chicago. And she got a degree in surgery. She's the first black female who got a degree in surgery at the University of Chicago. Her net was given, conferred upon her in the year 1895. But it didn't change the number of hours a day that my father and mother worked. My mother's a domestic maid. Father was a elevator operator. They said, it may be too late for us, it may not be, but one thing we know, we will never let it be too late for the 12 children of Mr. Warda. So over time, that was an all-white neighborhood. There were no black people out in Brighton Heights in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We were the only one. But my father built that design and built that house himself. He worked sometimes two jobs, whatever he could do, in order to provide independence. And for many, many years, this community, Brighton Heights, started developing. They wouldn't speak to the blacks. The only blacks there was our family. They were not going to do any speaking at that grade school. The teachers sometimes never call on a black. But you have to decide, who are you? Oh, just imagine what would have happened if back there in 1936, when I was born, just imagine that James Brown once a year would come by the house and say to the family, say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. So my father, my mother, hard work, determination, my brother, college, another brother, college, my sister, domestic maid. My father and mother had 12 children, but the most important thing in their life was to excel. Big gardens, we grew grapes, we grew cabbage, we grew plums, pears. This is how the family stayed alive. No excuses. We didn't walk around saying we hate white people. What we walked around saying is, say it loud. We are black and we're proud. Not that we individually are so great, but that a God, Allah, would provide vision, provide determination. When my father would buy cement, they would not bring it to our home. They took it about a mile to 2 miles away and dump it on the ground at Benton Avenue in Brighton Heights. And my father had to take a wheelbarrow when he wasn't working and take that sand and gravel and cement up steep hills. If you've ever been to Pittsburgh, you know where that is. But he would not give up. I have a picture. He would not give up. 12 children. And he tried to provide for us motivation. So in grade school, I was just an average student. I liked to play basketball, soccer, anything. But I didn't want to be reading books all the time. My older brothers and sisters, they were more gifted, more intelligent. So I just accepted if I could play a little basketball, I would not complain. Gradually, you know, and they had a few blacks in our school. Most of them were disruptive. They come from homes near a grade school. But we decided, upon my mother and father, we just were not going to give up. Now, I have to be frank with you. My older brothers and sisters were more intelligent than I. In fact, most of the family was more intelligent than I was. I had to work a little harder, but I found out that growing the grapes and growing the corn, growing the pears, apple, I mean, we had large, large apple trees. You got a sense of independence. You got a sense of saying to yourself that our time has come. Sometimes they would pass out little flyers all over the lawn. We had big, big lawn. And I don't know how many rooms were in that house. My father designed it and built it himself. No complaints. No excuses. We grew up My older brothers and sisters, they were more intelligent than I was. The younger ones, we didn't get all the genes that we should have. So from grade school to high school, I found a piece of paper on the ground all over high school. And based upon that application, I was selected to go to Europe, all expenses paid. And I was introduced to the lifestyle of Europe. And I learned little by little that you have to internalize self-help. Forget the excuses. Forget the saying, you know, white people, they had their foot on my neck and life has been so, forget all that. James said it. Say it loud. We are black and we're proud. How do we know? A grades, honor grades will make you feel good like black people should. So then to London, Italy, but they were paying all the expenses, but I was learning little by little. Ran into a few Africans, and they were trying to show me what racial pride really means. When I came back, I finished, went on to Howard University. I hadn't seen so many black people in my life. There were some who were just lazy or just trying to get by. There were others who were determined, A students. So I would watch them and see how much I could learn. Try to say, I wish I was intelligent as my sister. Wish that I was intelligent as my oldest brother. But I stuck with what I got. But little by little, I decided that I wanted to make friends who believed in themselves, who believed in the race, who believed that they could excel. And I start spending a little time with these black brothers and sisters. And they were encouraging me. Some of them were from homes where they were from institutional homes, but they still had a sense of racial pride. From there, all over high school, from there, Howard University. I hadn't seen so many blacks in my life. And one of the teachers at my high school, which was predominantly white, because our home was in a predominantly white area, well, they tried to discourage me from going to college. What are you going to do in college? What do you know? And I just kept talking about my father's sister. Said my father's sister got a degree from the University of Chicago in genetics. And she inspired us, and we promised her we would not let her down. So I went to Howard. I wasn't sure whether I'd be able to make it, whether I could get out of first year or second year, but I was determined. All these blacks, there was a sense of pride. We were not going to flunk out. We were not going to drop out. And then I would go back. And I was not a scholar now. I was just going home, and occasionally I would just ask questions of my father and mother. My older brother and sister, as soon as they were old enough, they went out, tried to get jobs so they could help support the family. One man building an entire house. I wish I could show you the whole race, what one black man could do with a black woman as his companion. Here are results that are within your grasp. Howard University, I found a piece of paper on the ground talking about coming to Howard. I didn't know what Howard was. I ended up going to Howard because they gave me a scholarship. I had never seen so many black people in my life, from Georgia, from Florida, from California, Arkansas, Tennessee. Said, whoa. Then they had some Africans. But the Africans were usually at the top of the class. The rest, Indians, Jamaica, Trinidad, usually at the top of the class. I said, I love, please. I just want to change. I don't have the ability that some of these brothers from Africa have or the Caribbean, but I got you, and I'm prepared to follow you and work if you will provide direction. And I can slowly start feeling a sense of confidence. I talked to my aunt, And I said, how did you get a degree from the university in Chicago? And she explained, you had to study, you had to be determined. And I started practicing. How does one learn how to be determined? And I went back in my neighborhood, you know, people were not that friendly. But I didn't care. What I was looking for was motivation to excel. At Harvard University, the black instructors, the E. Franklin Frasers, the John Hope Franklin, the William Banners, they took time out to encourage blacks. Black Howard was at least 95% black. The dormitory where we stayed was Cook Hall. And we would go to the faculty members and say, look, you have great instructors. You inspire people. What we'd like you to do is once a month come to Cook Hall and give us lectures about what epistemology is all about, English, Spanish. Just prove to us that it can be done. E. Franklin Frasier would come out there once a month. He would bring that book he wrote, Black Bourgeoisie. John Hope Franklin brought his history book. And little by little, we began to feel a sense of self-confidence. Howard Body, some were from Mississippi, Alabama, some from Pennsylvania, but we gradually developed a sense of motivation that we weren't going to let our parents down, we weren't going to let the teachers down, we were going to let ourselves down. We were going to excel. From there, Berkeley, California, and law school. And that was a very unusual place. Then in the whole law school, there was one black, and I was that black. But I didn't live in the law school. So as I began to walk out into the black neighborhood little by little and try to make friends, especially around the basketball courts, I felt the friendliness of the black community, the self-confidence. They believed what they could do. They played the music and the rhythms, start giving us the self-confidence that we didn't have before. In the law school, when I got there, there was one student in the law school. Everyone else, it may have a couple Hispanics, I don't, there may be one, but I mean, it was one black, but I decided that I wanted to graduate and I wanted to feel good like a black graduate should. So when I got there, I was only black in my class. Some of the instructors were more motivating than others, but generally the climate was, it's up to you. So I learned how to find the black neighborhood. I learned how to find the various outlets. I wasn't too interested in the public library, but had libraries right on the campus. There was about two or three students. John Don Hopkins was one of the students that came to UC Berkeley. It's few. But we decided that we needed knowledge. So we would meet in a cafeteria or maybe on the weekends. We were pursuing knowledge. So we read Ebony, we read Jet magazine. We also had to read contracts, we had to read finance, but we had a blended personality. In the hood, as it is called, that's what saved my life. There is the people I associated with, the brothers, none of us would have made it too far. But down in West Oakland, mounting on soapboxes, giving speeches, I learned a little bit about public speaking. I learned a little bit about preparing, researching. I learned a little bit about the slang. They would say, oh, man, you don't know what you're talking about. We don't understand what you're saying. I said, well, you tell me the right way of saying it. And they would put the slang out there, and I would repeat it. So little by little, I began to feel a sense of pride, not only in being black, but in the whole race itself. In Berkeley and Oakland, black there, we used to meet every Monday and every Friday. we were getting some of our meetings on Monday night, maybe 50, 75, 100 people, and it was like a lecture. Then on Friday night, 4022 Grove Street in the hood, it's like a seminar. We read books and exchange ideas. Our grades start going sky high because our confidence had been built up. We began to see that we were not going to flunk out. That wasn't even to be discussed. But we want to be at the top of the class. Are we ready? So Monday night and Friday nights were done. Ron Dellums, Donald Hopper, that's where that group came from. Every week no one was showing up. And on Saturday we had street meetings. Swan's Market, screaming and hollering, telling mothers, look out for your children. Young people, lift up your head. And somehow, I don't even know how it happened, I got a radio broadcast called The Match Line. And we started promoting Black is Beautiful. And the San Francisco, Richmond, Oakland community more and more started pursuing education. They took it seriously. And those meetings on Monday night and Friday, they not only grew, we learned how to think. We had instruction just among ourselves on logic and reason. And we learned how to differentiate between just abstraction and saying nothing and knowledge that could save the race and ourselves. Don Hopkins, Ron Dellums, Huey Newton. We were serious. We did not let any white people at the meeting. Because that's what people would say. Well, they learned because the white people, you know, were able to hypnotize them. No, we did this, Black people. Then on Saturday, in order to get the parents to be involved, to have self-confidence like my parents with 12 children. My mother and father had 12 children. But you learn to share. You learn to focus. You learn to achieve. And that's what we were learning in those street meetings in West Oakland. That's what we were learning when there was recess in school. We were going to the cafeteria. We didn't have much money, but we promoted the importance of education. Then, I will go much faster, Howard University, I met more Blacks. I had not seen that many Blacks in my life. Some of their parents were doctors, lawyers. My father operated an elevator in the post office, but that did not give me an inferiority complex. I could visualize all those apples, oranges, pears, and I could see the results of suppressing laziness, stopping excuse making, and make up your mind. Rise and unite the Black man's back. So from Howard, I found a piece of paper on the ground, so that got me to Europe, all expenses paid. So I went to London, I went to Spain, I went to Italy, and I started learning a little bit more about cross-cultural development. Then graduated from Berkeley, and I think I was, if my memory is correct, either... Let's see, I'm pretty sure I was the third African-American to graduate in the history of University of California School of Law. But that was an incentive. Our meetings on Friday night in West Oakland would come and try to provide us with motivation. Huey Newton would come. Bobby Seale, they would say, look here, brother, we can't play around. It is now or never. So people start reading books. They start talking to their friends. Some of the young ladies said, we ain't dating no one if they do not do well in school. So it became a contagious movement based on knowledge. Not showing off. Weren't trying to brag. Knowledge. That led to a radio broadcast called The Match Line. So that got larger and larger crowds on Monday and Friday at 4022 Grove Street. But increasingly, some of the African students in the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, came to the meetings. And we began to develop a respect for our roots. we would tell the brothers, are you from Ghana? Are you from Nigeria? What'd you do? Did they have spears? What was going on? And they began to share with us the capacity and capability of people of African descent if they are prepared to use their ability. And remember, brother from Nigeria told us, each one teach one. You go to the cafeteria at lunchtime, each one teach one. Motivate. The street meetings on the weekend, this became contagious. The radio broadcast became contagious. And finally, a radio broadcast called the Match Line. People would call in and say, Match Line, what's that mean? Say, we're matching success with being black and proud. And people began to internalize it. They began to feel it. Then ABC, San Francisco, Channel 7, said, would you do this television show? I said, we might be able to think about it, but I got to get permission from our group and the name we select. We cannot have a name imposed on us. That's what happened when they start calling us Negroes during slavery. They wanted to make sure that we felt inferior forever. So Channel 7 said, what name do you want? I said, the name we want is Black Dignity. They are redundant. If you're black, you should have dignity. And that was the name of the program on Channel 7, ABC, in the Bay Area. So we had call-in, we had lectures, but there was a spirit of determination. It was important to blacks to get good grades. We weren't showing off. We weren't trying to say to white people, look, we as intelligent as you are, we don't get involved in all that. What we're saying is say it loud. We're going to be black and proud, and we want honor grades. Meet in the cafeteria, exchange ideas, and grow the minds. Incredible. Incredible. Black pride was the top of the agenda. And that helped build my confidence. I didn't have the confidence when I was visiting some of the churches. That didn't give me any confidence. I didn't have the confidence when I was in grade school. I doubted whether I could ever master the curriculum to excel. I wasn't always sure. But when we started those street meetings, West Oakland, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, people were just trying to do their shopping at Swan's Market. They heard all that screaming. They said, come on back here. Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, anyone can come and blow, but it was motivational. Young people came, parents came, large crowds came, and it gave us more and more and more motivation. Then I got a couple scholarships to kind of move around to see. Then it came time to say, Khaled, Allah has been good to you as he was to your family. Allah has given you an opportunity to learn. The first thing, your father was a Muslim, but why didn't you ask him what igra, igra, igra means? My father just took it for granted that if he heard me screaming and hollering about igra, 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 it would be race riots all over the place. So finally, after college, he sat me down and said, brother, here it is. So I said, Pop, look, I'll never be able to repay you for what you did. He told me, you're just starting. You read, you think. You think and you read. Continue to play basketball. Continue to use your mind. Exercise your mind. Walk, jog, be in good physical condition because it will make you feel good like black people should. So from those influences, Berkeley, the hood,